Hello, everybody. Welcome back to I'm Not Crazy Podcast. Cameron Jones here, along with my co-host,
Nicole.
So in my last few episodes, we were doing parallel universes and time.
Right.
I came across a lot of curious cases where people seem to appear out of nowhere.
Interesting.
So sometimes this seemed like cases maybe of time travel and others of like reality jumps. So it could have fit into those episodes. But I didn't want to just gloss over some of these stories because some of them are fun mysteries. So I figured I would give all these people their own episodes today.
Wait, can you kind of elaborate on that? Are these like people that are just that have shown up in different like time periods? Because you know like how there's like photographs of like people and they're like, huh, this person looks similar to this person, or
yeah,
that person just doesn't belong there.
Okay, yeah. No, not so much that. These are just like actual, some of them are folklore cases, some of them are historical things, some are police reports
okay.
of people who have maybe even, who have come from a different time period or possibly just weird enough that they're from a different universe. And
okay.
it's just a little boo, hard to clarify.
Okay, all right.
So the first one we have today is Kaspar Hauser.
Uh-huh.
Kaspar Hauser was a German youth who claimed to have grown up in total isolation in a darkened cell.
Mm-hmm.
Hauser's claims and his mysterious death from a stab wound sparked much debate and controversy over his true identity.
He just got stabbed randomly?
Mm-hmm. He died from an attack.
Okay.
Theories propounded at the time ranging from hidden royalty to a simple fraud. Let's see if we can find any hidden clues mm-hmm. to who Kaspar Hauser may have truly been.
Okay.
But probably not. This is very old and lots of people have looked into it. But okay. we're going to do it anyway.
Fun.
On the 26th of May, 1828, a teenage boy appeared in the streets of Nuremberg, Germany. Mm-hmm. He carried a letter with him addressed to the captain of the 4th Squadron of the 6th Cavalry Regiment, Captain von Wessenig. Captain von Wessenig. It's heading red.
Mm-hmm.
From the Bavarian border. The place is unnamed. 1812. So that's the heading on the letter.
Okay.
The anonymous author said the boy was given into his custody as an infant on the 7th of October, 1812.
Mm-hmm.
And that he was instructed, and he instructed the boy in reading, writing, and the Christian religion.
Okay, so knowledgeable.
Yeah, but never let him take a single step outside of the house. He's never seen daylight.
So he was homeschooled, basically.
To the extreme, though.
Yeah.
The letter stated that the boy would now like to be a cavalryman as his father was and invited the captain to either take him into the army or hang him and just kill him.
What?
Those are the options. Pretty drastic swings there.
Pretty, yeah. No.
You could also maybe just let him go and wander instead
yeah.
of forcing him into...
Just either let him join
yeah.
or death.
Yeah. Pretty
no
drastic.
Other option. Okay.
So there was another short letter enclosed, supposedly said to be from his mother, which was given to the prior caretaker, the guy that...
Wait, he was taken in by someone else, so he was adopted regardless, right? So he wouldn't know about his mother.
No. So he was an infant, but... So he had two letters... This boy had two letters with him. One was from the person who just abandoned him that
right.
said, like, essentially, I've housed the boy, I taught him in this, he's never stepped a foot outside.
Right.
And then this other letter was just written to his mother, which was given to that caretaker when he was abandoned with him.
Okay, so he had those two letters with him in hand.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
So it stated that his name was Kaspar, and that he was born on April 30th, 1812.
Okay.
And that his father, a cavalryman of the 6th Regiment, was dead.
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, though, this letter was found to be in the exact same handwriting as the first one.
Okay. Red flag right there.
Yeah,
great.
Pretty big red flag.
Okay.
And he even indicates in a line saying, he writes in my handwriting exactly as I do, like the person that the second caretaker saying, like, I trained him so well that you may notice that this handwriting is an exact match. So,
you know, that kind of just puts a little tingle in my brain saying
yeah,
that the
tingles me other places too. Oh. So
great. Cool.
This Weird. Has led people to assume that Kaspar Hauser may have written the letter himself, both of them.
Right.
But we'll get into this a little more.
Okay.
So, a shoemaker named Wickman took the boy to the house of Captain von Wessenig,
mm-hmm.
Where he would repeat only the words, I want to be a cavalryman as my father was, and horse, horse!
What?
Those are the two things he says.
Okay.
So any further demands or questions would elicit tears and cries of, don't know, don't know! So those were the only things he would say. He was taken to a police station.
You know, with his sheltered education that he was given, I would think he would be able to shout a little bit more than that.
No, again, though, well, we were going to look a little more into his education. So it's okay. He didn't have much of one.
I know, but it sounds pretty promising what, you know, he was able to read and write.
Yeah, but
any religion.
Well, I'm going to get into this in a second, but he only started learning like a couple months ago, as opposed to living in total isolation in a darkened cell his entire life.
Mm.
So hold your opinions before we find out.
Hold your
more.
Horses, yeah. As some would say. Okay.
He was taken to a police station where he would write his name, Casper Hauser.
Mm-hmm.
He showed that he was familiar with money. He could say some prayers and he could read a little, but he answered very few questions. And his vocabulary was, as we said, very, very limited.
Wait, how old was he?
16-ish, approximately, a teenager, late teens.
Okay.
Because he was because he could provide no account for himself, he was imprisoned as a vagabond.
What's a vagabond?
Just a wanderer, just like a bum, essentially.
A nomad?
Yeah, kind of, yeah. Jobless, just wander. So at least they didn't hang him or put him in the army. So, you know, that's something. So he spent the following 2 months in the Tower of Nuremberg Castle in the care of the jailer named Andreas Hiltl, almost said Hitler. Close, though.
Mm-hmm.
Despite what many later accounts would say, he was in good physical condition and could walk well. So apparently there were versions of the story that he was deformed and maybe kind of a hunchback. But he wasn't. He had to walk 90 steps to reach his room. He was physically capable and just was a healthy facial complexion, it was said, and approximately 16 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But he was heavily and intellectually impaired, it seemed.
Okay.
The mayor, Mayor Binder, however, claimed that the boy had an excellent memory and was learning quickly. Various curious people visit him to his apparent delight. He liked visitors.
Mm-hmm.
And he refused all food except bread and water during this time. So he was just eating a prison diet.
Okay.
So here's where we get Hauser's account of his early life.
Yeah.
At first, it was assumed that Hauser was a half-wild child of the forest, just someone who lived...
Ugh, feral children.
Yeah, raised by wolf situation.
No. Not my worst nightmare, but
such a random worst nightmare.
They freak me out.
Okay, good to know. Weird.
No, it's not weird. Have you ever watched a documentary on feral children?
I guess
absolutely
not.
Terrifying.
Okay, well.
Terrifying.
I know what we're doing an episode on in the future, though, I guess. But during the course of many conversations with Mayor Binder, Hauser shot down this theory and told a very different version of his past, which he later wrote down in a little more detail.
Okay.
So according to his story, as long as he could remember, he spent his life in solitary confinement in a darkened cell.
Mm-hmm.
He gave the cell's dimension as approximately 2 meters long, 1 meter wide, and a half meter high. So it's essentially a box to lay. It's like a little coffin, it sounds like. It's not that high.
So 2 meters long, so that's like what?
Six feet? Yeah.
And then?
1 meter wide and then a half meter high. So like 3 feet tall.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah, so he was just laying in a box, essentially. Yeah. With only a straw bed to sleep on and 4 toys. He had 2 horses and a dog carved out of wood.
Okay.
So granted, people were smaller back then, but that's pretty tight. And
yeah.
I do need a stiffer mattress, though, so maybe I'll see how straw works on cement for me.
Mm-hmm.
So Hauser claimed that he found rye bread and water next to his bed each morning. So probably that's why it's all he wants to eat.
Right.
At times, the water would taste bitter, and drinking it would cause him to sleep more deeply than usual. So he was getting drugged.
Yeah.
On these occasions, when he would awake, the straw for his bed would be changed, and his hair and nails had been cut. However, Hauser claimed the first human being he had ever met who visited him was not long before his release from his confinement.
Interesting.
So almost 15 years in a darkened box without seeing any human or having any contact with anybody.
Hmm.
Almost 16 years of being treated worse than an animal, according to him.
Yeah.
The man took great care not to reveal his face to the boy.
So
he
would just be in this bed all the time?
All, like this 24-7, little... he was in
So he would cell. Soil himself.
You'd assume. Or maybe we'll get into it. He might have a bucket. I don't know. But I mean, he wasn't taught anything. He was treated like an animal.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay.
The man took great care not to reveal his face to the boy. Mm-hmm. And this man taught him how to stand and walk. Because, again, he was laying all his life, apparently. As well as to write his name.
He would have sores on him.
You would assume he'd have a ton of problems.
Yeah.
As well as write his own name by leading his hand. He would just hold his hand, and that's how he claimed he wrote exactly like him, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere in there, I guess he taught him Bible passages, too, because, I mean, he could recite some stuff.
Yeah.
If he was just meeting a human before being released, though, after 16 years without contact, I would assume he'd be much more, as we were saying, feral and wild and just deformed and, like, bed sores. And
right.
He would be a shell of a human, you would assume.
Right.
So the stranger allegedly taught him to say the phrase, "I want to be a cavalryman, as my father was," in an old Bavarian dialect. But Hauser claimed that he did not understand what the words meant. So it kind of sucks he was just being brought into town and dipped and being told to say, "Hang me or put me to service," essentially, with having no idea what that was. So the tale aroused great curiosity and made Hauser an object of international attention. It was getting publicized at this point.
Rightfully so.
Rumors arose that he was of princely parentage, possibly a royal heir, in hiding for his own safety to conceal the heir from, you know, through killing. You know, we've all seen Game of Thrones. We know how this stuff works. So Paul John Anselm Ritter von Fehrbach, what a name. Jeez.
Say that again.
Paul John Anselm Ritter von Fehrbach.
Fun.
President of the Bavarian Court of Appeals began to investigate the case.
Okay.
Hauser was formally adopted by the town of Nuremberg, and money was donated for his upkeep and education. The town owned the boy now, in kind of a Truman Show situation.
Mm-hmm.
He was given into the care of Friedrich Dahmer, a schoolmaster and speculative philosopher who taught him various subjects and who discovered his talent for drawing. He was a bit of an artiste.
Hmm.
He apparently flourished in this environment, and it was a happy period for Hauser's young little life.
Right.
Dahmer also subjected him to homeopathy and magnetic experiments. This is where things get a little weird here. So we're experimenting on the boy now.
Right.
As Fehrbach said, when Professor Dahmer held the north pole of a magnet towards him, Casper, Casper put his hands towards the pit of his stomach and, drawing his waistcoat in an outward direction, said that it drew him thus, and that a current of air seemed to proceed from him.
What?
The south pole affected less powerfully and said that it blew upon him. So apparently the north pole of the magnet is sucking his belly and creating a wind vortex, and the north pole's pushing him. Again, I'm not sure why we're doing this to the boy.
I'm confused.
Yeah, but I get, I mean,
also, what's the purpose of this experiment?
I don't know.
Holding a magnet to a kid and just saying,
mystery boy trying mysterious stuff. I don't know, but could it be his belt or pants button possibly being tugged by a magnet? I don't know.
Okay.
We're going to put that aside, though.
It's fucking weird.
On October 17th, 1829, Hauser was found in the cellar of Dahmer's house, bleeding from a wound on his forehead.
Okay.
He claimed that when he was sitting on the privy toilet, he was on the john, he had been attacked and hurt by a hooded man who also threatened him with the words, "You have still to die before you leave the city of Nuremberg."
What?
Oh, yeah. Hauser related that he recognized the speaker as the man who had brought him to Nuremberg in the first place, his first caretaker who had just taught him how to, you know, be a human.
Right.
So possibly that was the letter's inspiration to send him to the army or the gallows. It was just like, kill him or send him somewhere to die quickly, kind of. Maybe that was the intent.
Weird again.
So as was obvious from the blood trail, they followed it for clues.
Yeah.
Hauser at first fled to the first floor where his room was. So he went from the privy outside to the first floor.
Okay.
But then rather than moving to find his caretaker, he had gone downstairs and climbed through a trapdoor into the cellar. So somewhat odd behavior. He went outside to the privy, upstairs to his room, then downstairs to the cellar where he was found.
Huh.
So alarmed officials called for the police escort to transfer him into the care of John Baerbeck, a municipal authority.
Mm-hmm.
The alleged attack on Hauser also fueled rumors about his possible ancestry from Hungary, England, or the House of Baden. So these were all, again, Game of Thrones, royal family kind of situations.
Right.
Likely suspects and families of the time.
Yeah.
So doubters of Hauser's story are in the opinion that he had self-inflicted the wound with a razor, which he then took back to his room before going down to the cellar. So that's what doubters today, not so much at the time, but people today speculate.
Okay.
He might have done so to arouse pity and thus escape chiding for a recent fight he had had with Dahmer, his current caretaker.
Mm-hmm.
Would come to believe that the boy had a tendency to lie.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-oh. So after being confronted about his lies and inconsistencies with his stories, there was coincidentally an attempt on his life, which got him moved and credibility and sympathy from the public again.
Right.
On April 3rd, 1830, a pistol shot went off in Hauser's room in the Bierbach house, his new caretaker's where he just got moved to.
Yeah.
His escort hurriedly entered the room and found him bleeding from a wound to the right side of his head, another head wound. Mm-hmm. Hauser soon revived and stated that he climbed on a chair to get some books, and then that chair had fallen, and while he had tried to get a handhold, he had mistakenly torn down a decorative pistol that was on the wall and apparently loaded. Sketchy.
What?
Yeah, so he's falling backwards, and then he grabbed a loaded pistol from the wall. There are doubts immediately on this one, whether the superficial wound was actually caused by a gunshot.
Yeah.
So some authors associate the incident, again, preceding a quarrel in which Hauser had been approached for lying. So he got caught lying with the new caretaker, and again, he's injured soon after.
So the theme of this so far is the caretakers seem to, as soon as they suspect that he's lying,
something
happens incidentally, and then he sways
public opinion. And
Okay.
So whatever the case was, the occurrence led the municipal authorities to come to another decision on Hauser, whose initial good relationship with the Bierbach family had soured. In May 1830, he was transferred to the house of Baron von Entutcher.
Fun names.
Again, great titles for these people.
Yeah.
The Baron also would later complain about Hauser's extraordinary vanity and lies. Mrs. Bierbach commented on his horrendous mendacity and art of disillusionment, and called him full of vanity and spite. So we have three accounts.
Just the fucking liars, yeah, basically what they're saying.
We have three accounts from caretakers now that he was a dick and a liar.
Kind of.
And problematic.
Yeah.
Not surprised if he lived 16 years in isolation in a box.
But if that is even true.
Which it probably isn't based on just his current actions on and how he should be, probably. Right. Theoretically. Okay. A British nobleman, Lord Stanhope, took an interest in Hauser and gained custody of him in 1831.
Okay.
He spent a great deal of money attempting to clarify Hauser's origins. Mm-hmm. In particular, he paid for two visits to Hungary, hoping to jog the boy's memory, as Hauser seemed to remember some Hungarian words and had once declared that the Hungarian countess was his mother. He had seen an image or heard her and was like, oh, that's my mom. So this was going off the assumption that he was royalty and that this was the most likely fit for him.
Okay.
Hauser failed to recognize any buildings, monuments, or anything in Hungary. Mm-hmm. A Hungarian nobleman who had met Hauser later told Stanhope that he and his son had a good laugh when they recollected the strange boy and his odd behavior. So everyone there doubted. The Hungarian nobility was also like, I don't know about this kid.
Right.
Stanhope later wrote that the complete failure of these inquiries led him to doubt Hauser's credibility. In December,
surprise.
So another caretaker. Mm-hmm. In December 1831,
how many caretakers is this guy flying through?
We're running to the end of the people who are putting up with this.
Okay.
In December 1831, he transferred Hauser to Ansbach to the care of schoolmaster named Johann Georg Mayer.
Okay.
And in January 1832, Stanhope left Hauser for good. And there's a good chance this kid is a fraud. But if he does have some psychological issues,
I would have never guessed.
The only explanation I can have is that if he was really in isolation, he does have behavioral issues. But again, it should be worse, you'd assume.
Yeah.
So Stanhope continued to pay for Hauser's living expenses, but never made good on his promise that he would take him to England to start a new life and kind of, you know, adopt him.
Yeah.
After Hauser's death, which we'll get to in a second, Stanhope published a book in which he presented all known evidence against
Hauser. Wait, Hauser died?
Remember, we opened with that he died from a stab. He dies from a stab wound under suspicious circumstances.
Suspicious.
So after his death.
Or self-inflicted, should we say?
We'll see. So after his death, which we will get to. Stanhope published a book in which he presented all the known evidence against Hauser, taking it as his duty openly to confess that I had been deceived.
Okay.
Followers and believers of Hauser, though, suspect that Stanhope had ulterior motives and might have been connected to the House of Baden, one of these royal families. So he was possibly just trying to discredit this boy's story and make arrangements for his future assassination to become easier. That's what... doubters.
I love the gossip.
That's what doubters suspect.
Okay.
But let's see what you think.
Okay.
because academics and historians defend him as a philanthropist and a pious man and a seeker of truth. So he likely realized he was being hoodwinked and just wanted to publicly, you know, say, no, he's a liar.
Yeah.
So the schoolmaster, Meyer, mm-hmm. who was a strict and pedantic man, disliked Hauser's excuses and constant lies, okay. naturally.
Right.
Their relationship was said to be very strained. In 1832, Hauser was employed as a copyist in a local law office.
Okay.
He still had hopes that Hanwood would take him to England, and Hauser was dissatisfied with his situation, which deteriorated further when his former patron, Anselm van Feuerbach, died in May 1833.
Natural causes, or is this...
Yeah, nothing
okay.
weird here.
Okay.
But this was a grievous loss for him. The authors point out that Feuerbach had lost his faith in Hauser, but Hauser didn't know that, so he kind of assumed still that this was going to be his possible father figure, maybe.
Hmm.
So on December 9th, 1833, Hauser had a serious argument with Mayer. Lord Stanhope was expected to visit on Christmas, and Mayer stated that he didn't know how he could possibly face him. Stanhope, that is. Like, I don't think he's coming.
Right.
If you can follow the pattern, there's a typical bad accident following any argument or reprimanding. So 5 days later, on December 14th, mm-hmm. 1833, mm-hmm. Hauser came home with a deep wound on his left breast. By his account, he had been lured to the court garden, where a stranger stabbed him while giving him a bag.
What?
When police searched the court garden, they found a small violet purse containing a penciled note in mirrored writing, so kind of hidden.
Yeah.
And it was a message in German, which read, "Hauser will be able to tell you quite precisely how I look and from where I am.
Mm-hmm.
To save Hauser the effort, I want to tell you myself where I come. I come from the Bavarian border, on the river. I will even tell you my name, M-L-O. That's all it says.
Mm-hmm.
Hauser died of the wound on December 17th, 1833.
Mm-hmm.
So let's break all this down now. I think I've already led you to an assumption, which is correct.
Yeah.
Inconsistencies in Hauser's account led the Ansbach Court of Inquiry to suspect that he had stabbed himself and then invented the tale about being attacked.
Right, which is what I think.
Yeah. The note in the purse was found to be in the court garden, contained spelling errors and grammatical errors, both of which were typical for Hauser.
But did it look like Hauser's handwriting?
Who, on his deathbed, also incoherently said something about writing with a pencil. So it seems like maybe he was even kind of being like, I did it.
Okay.
Although Hauser was eager that the purse was to be found, he didn't ask for the contents or what was inside. He was just like, you need to find that purse. But then when they found it, he was like, okay, good. So also a little weird.
Yeah.
The note itself was folded into a specific triangle in a way in which Hauser was said to fold his letters, according to Meyer and other former caretakers.
Mm-hmm.
Forensic examiners agreed that the wound might indeed be self-inflicted.
Mm-hmm.
Many authors believe that he had wounded himself in a bid to revive the public interest again, persuade Stanhope to fulfill his promise to take him to England.
Seems to be a theme for this man.
Yeah, and just in general, maybe get moved on to the next family.
Mm-hmm.
But he messed up and he stabbed too deeply and accidentally killed himself. So
way to go, Casper.
So who was Casper Hauser really, and where did he come from?
Okay.
Dr. Friedrich Wilhelm Heinrich, a physician who was present at the autopsy, claimed that the brain of Casper Hauser was notable for small cortical size and its few distinct cortical gyri.
Can you break that down a little bit?
Indicative that he suffered some cortical atrophies, or his brain was little in areas and underdeveloped, he was saying. Right. And there's a good chance that he suffered from epilepsy.
Okay.
But this should be taken with a huge grain of salt, because his conclusions were based on phrenology, which is the measurements of bumps on the skull to predict mental traits and problems and health issues.
What?
This is a doctor who looked at bumps and lumps on his head and said, well, based on these lumps, here's what's going on with his brain.
He's got a little brain.
He didn't look at his brain at all.
He's got a little brain, and I think he had seizures.
Mm-hmm. So let's throw that out.
Yeah.
Dr. Albert, who conducted the actual autopsy, saw the brain and was there and wrote the official report.
Let me see. It was a normal-sized brain.
Found no abnormalities at all. It was normal.
Great. Who would have thought?
Yep. So in 1928, a medical study...
Just going to look at someone's head and be like, you know what?
I'll admit, this first one really isn't much of a mystery, but it was just a big mystery at the time. You know, okay. It was a huge one.
Yeah.
So in 1928, a medical study supported the view that Hauser... had self-inflicted the wound.
Just keep thinking about looking at someone's head and just seeing lumps and bumps.
There's also a form of future telling where you look at someone's bare ass. That we'll look into. Sylvester Stallone's mother does it. I forget what it's called. Yeah, you look at someone's butt and you can predict their future.
Huh.
Mm-hmm. We'll look at that someday. We'll break that down.
What is this?
I don't know. So 1929 medical examination did an examination of it, and they said it's self-inflicted. He stabbed himself too deeply.
Mm-hmm.
2005, moving now to the future, present time, kind of. Forensic analysis argued that it's unlikely that the stab to his chest was inflicted exclusively for self damage or suicidal or homicidal intent.
Well, I'm sure it wasn't intentional for him to kill himself.
That's what I'm saying. So they're saying, like, we don't think he meant to do it, but I think that's what we were all assuming. I think it was just a ploy for intention.
Yeah. Okay.
So let's wrap him up real quick.
Yeah.
Hauser's various accounts of the story and of his incarceration included several contradictions, obviously.
Right.
In 1970, psychiatrist Carl Leonhard stated that if he had been living since childhood under the conditions that he described, he would have not developed beyond the condition of an idiot, and he would have remained, and he wouldn't have remained like alive long in that situation. He shouldn't have just living, laying in a box.
Mm-hmm.
So his tale is full of absurdities, and it's astonishing that anyone believed it at the time. Mm-hmm. Granted, limited view of psychology and stuff, but still, people were kind of onto him though.
Mm-hmm.
Carl Leonhard contended that Caspar Hauser was, as other authors have already opinioned, a pathological swindler. In addition to his hysterical makeup, he probably had the persistencies of a paranoid personality since he was able to play his role so perfectly. From many reports on his behavior, one can recognize the hysterical as well as the paranoid trend of his personality.
Mm-hmm.
So it's likely he did have mental issues, but not from living in a box.
Yeah.
Could he really have been a royal? Is there any credibility to this?
I don't think so.
According to the contemporary rumors that he was hereditary prince of Baden, a German prince who would have been born September 29th, 1812.
Mm-hmm.
So according to history, that prince died on October 16th, 1812. And it was alleged that he would have been switched with a dying infant only to, you know, resurface 16 years later as Hauser and then die anyway. So
I feel like that might be a stretch.
It is. But we do have DNA testing. We have some science here.
Okay.
So in that case, Hauser's parents would have been Charles, Grand Duke of Baden, and Stephanie de Bohannes.
I was hoping that was going to be her last Stephanie name. Would have been great.
No, Stephanie de Bohannes or something.
Okay.
Cousin by marriage and the adopted daughter of Napoleon. We know him.
Okay.
So now we need to untangle some confusing family connections here. But I've never really cared about family connections, so I get lost. So as Charles had no surviving male progeny, his successor was his uncle, Louis, who was later succeeded by his half-brother, Leopold.
Okay.
And Leopold's mother, the Countess of Hochberg, was allegedly the culprit for this baby swindling switching plot.
Okay.
So follow that, if you will, but...
Okay. So kind of following along. All right.
So the Countess was supposed to have disguised herself as a ghost, the White Lady...
Mm-hmm.
when kidnapping the prince so that people would just be like, oh my God, a spirit, get out of here.
Right.
Her motive evidently would have been to secure the succession for her sons for the throne.
Mm-hmm.
So following Hauser's death, it was further claimed that he was murdered again to hide this true identity and the challenge of the throne. So the powers that be at the time were like, well, stab him, we found him.
Yeah.
In 1876, Otto Mittelstadt presented evidence against this theory. Mm-hmm. In the form of official documents concerning the prince's emergency baptism. So records at the time. Oops. Sorry, everybody. I've just been informed that my leg has been shaking the camera and it's probably
I've been watching it and I'm like, my camera's shaking. And then I'm staring at the desk and then I'm watching you and I'm like, it's you.
Oops. So sorry about however long that's been happening. But so there were records of this.
Right.
The autopsy. It is true that the Grand Duchess was too ill to be permitted to see her dead baby, apparently. So she wouldn't have even seen him. But then the baby's father, grandmother, and aunt, and 10 court physicians, nurses, and others had all seen the death and documented this. So it's very unlikely she switched out a baby. I'm just going to skip ahead here because they did do forensic testing. But because much like with England, a lot of royal families do not release DNA. They do not dig up families to any of these mysteries. The whole thing being because it could overturn whole monarchy, as in like family lines, like any baby switching rumors would and history and stuff. So they did some testing on a descendant of a descendant of like a possible,
just to see if there's any matches.
And it was just inconclusive. It was like, well, there are matches, but not conclusively enough to say that it's like the family.
Yeah.
And that's all we have. So he's a liar. That's him. Mm. Up next, we have Rudolph Fence.
Okay.
This one's fun and a little shorter.
Okay.
In 1950, a New York City police officer was working a missing persons case and examined the body of an approximately 30-year-old man that was brought to the morgue.
Okay.
The man had shown up in the middle of Times Square at 11:15 p.m.,
mm-hmm.
gawking and looking around at the cars and up at the signs like he'd never seen them before.
Okay. Doesn't sound abnormal, but okay.
Then he was suddenly killed and struck by a cab when he was trying to cross the street and just went against the street lights.
Well, oops.
The pockets of the deceased clothing held multiple pieces of coinage and currency of forms that had not been produced for several decades, mm-hmm. yet they were in mint condition.
Mm-hmm.
His possessions also included items from types of businesses that no longer existed in New York City, a bill from a stable and a brass slug from a saloon.
Hmm.
A letter postmarked from 1876 and cards bearing the name Rudolph Fence with an address on Fifth Avenue were also found in his possession.
Interesting.
Further investigation turned up no listings for a Rudolph Fence in New York City's phone directories. The Fifth Avenue address listed the dead man's card had a business rather than the residence for many years where he should have been living.
Mm-hmm.
And no one had heard of Rudolph Fence.
Mm-hmm.
The deceased fingerprints matched none on file, and no current missing persons report or inquiries fit the details of the body in the morgue.
Okay.
Moreover, the dead man's clothes appear to be about 75 years out of date.
Mm-hmm.
We have our first possible time travel one here.
Okay.
His apparel bore tags with the name and address of a tailor whom no one had ever heard of, and his hat bore a tag from a store that had gone out of business many years earlier.
He thrifted it.
Could this just be a cosplay, the first steampunk? Possibly. Let's look further into this.
Okay.
The case was handed over to Captain Hubert Rim, mm-hmm. who worked for the Missing Persons Department of the NYPD.
Mm-hmm.
The investigating officer finally turned up a listing in an old phone directory for Rudolph Fence Jr., a man in his 60s who had passed away 5 years earlier.
How old did this man look?
In his 30s, I believe.
Okay.
So his widow of the Rudolph Fence Jr.,
mm-hmm.
Had since moved to Florida, but by mail she replied some information about her husband's father, Rudolph Fence Sr.
Okay.
He had apparently disappeared sometime in the 1870s, having gone for a walk around 10 p.m., and he had never returned.
Mm.
A search of a missing persons report from 1876 turned up the report for Rudolph Fence, whose clothing and address corresponded to the man killed in Times Square in 1950. Ooh, spooky, scary. Yeah.
Well, not scary, but wild.
Mysterious.
Sure.
Sure enough, when Rim checked the missing persons files for 1876, Fence was there.
Mm-hmm.
Descriptions of his appearance, age, and clothing all match the man who laid in the morgue before him.
Hmm.
So rather than risk being seen as a laughingstock, Rim closed the case, marking it as unresolved. It was all too strange for his liking.
Mm-hmm.
This report from the NYPD captain about the unexplained disappearance and inexplicable reappearance 74 years later mm-hmm. of what appeared to be Rudolph Fence had been reproduced in various forms since 1970 as one of many tales that seemingly confirms the existence of time travel. But if we do a little research, it appears that this story actually isn't true, even though isn't that a good story?
It's a good one.
Yeah, don't you wish this one was true?
Yeah, kind of.
So let's look into the truth. In 2000, a folklore researcher, Chris Abrek, began investigating this story after it appeared in a Spanish magazine portrayed as a factual report. He discovered that the story had originally appeared in the 1972 May-June issue of the Journal of Borderland Research, again as a factual report, though.
Mm-hmm.
Some digging found that the magazine had gotten the Fence story from a 1953 book, A Voice from the Gallery, by Ralph M. Holland. The following year, he published his findings and was amazed when Pastor George Murphy reached out to correct him and informed him of the actual source material for this story. So it turned out Holland had plagiarized this story from either a 1952 Robert Heinlein science fiction anthology, Tomorrow, the Stars, or a short story published in the Collier's Magazine called I'm Scared. Either way, it's a plagiarized story, so it's not true. Mm-hmm. But isn't that a good one?
Yeah, Yeah, it's a fun one.
Yeah, I like that one a lot. Yeah, I wish that one was real. That's the fun sci-fi one.
Yeah, that one's a cool one.
Sorry to burst everyone's bubble. So a lot of these ones, I am just bursting a bubble here, but...
Wow, why do you have to... Why do you have to do that?
These are the main big ones you always see on the internet. And I just want to, we're setting the record straight for people. That's what we do here at I'm Not Crazy. We get to the bottom of the truth here, everybody.
But do we?
Sometimes when it's obvious and in your face. Here's an unsolved mystery. We don't know this one.
Okay.
This is Jerome of Sandy Cove.
Okay.
So Jerome is the name given to an unidentified man discovered on a beach of Sandy Cove, Nova Scotia on September 8th, 1963.
Okay.
He was found with both legs cut off to stumps, and when questioned by locals, he said very little, suggesting that he did not speak English or French. When asked for his name, he mumbled something.
Wait, what? He just appeared with stumps?
He was found on the beach in Nova Scotia with his legs amputated, freshly amputated. Yes, we'll get into this. And he also just didn't speak any languages, well, any English or French.
Okay.
When asked for his name, he mumbled.
I just wanted to make sure that they were fresh stumps.
Yeah, we'll see that it wasn't a great situation.
Okay.
So when he was asked his name, he mumbled something that resembled Jerome. So that's just what he became known as. His discovery in classic fashion was found by an 8-year-old boy named George Colin Colley.
Jesus.
Yeah, he's going to scar this kid for a while.
Yeah.
But he brought Albright to his village, the nearby Digby Neck.
What did he do? Carry Stumpman on his back to his village?
I don't know. I'm not a little sure about that. So maybe he just got somebody. But he brought him back to the
and
village.
Be like, hey, there's a
guy without legs on the beach who's dying.
He's just, it doesn't look good and I need help.
You know, we've been watching a lot of MasterChef Junior though, and kids are stronger than we think and they're better at
They're capable of doing capable. A lot more than I can at 34 years old.
So let's look at to this amputation and maybe how we got here.
Okay.
So both of Jerome's legs had been amputated just above the knee with evidence that it had been done with surgical skill.
Okay.
So at least wasn't something horrific that happened at sea probably, but still. The stumps,
it's still crazy.
The stumps were only partially healed and still bandaged when he was found. He was also suffering from cold and exposure. You can imagine right. He was out in the ocean. So not great. Recent amputation, soaking in the ocean probably for a day or so.
Mm-hmm.
Many people, eager to know more about him, visited his sickbed and through it discovered that he could not or did not understand French, Latin, Italian, or Spanish, and English, as we said. He apparently shunned the attention of these curious onlookers, growling like a dog at all these unwanted guests.
Is this another feral human?
No, you just can't exactly. Maybe somewhat. Can't exactly blame him, though. He just doesn't want a bunch of looky-loos coming into his room and trying to interrogate him.
So he just growls at him?
Yeah, if he doesn't like him. The man's hands were noted as being...
Can you imagine if he did like a person?
Good grunt.
You know? Can't.
The man's hands were noted as being too soft for him to be a manual laborer. Mm-hmm. So he was described as being Mediterranean in appearance and an indoor boy, if you will. An indoor Mediterranean man.
Like you.
Yes.
He's an indoor boy.
The Albright struggled to support another mouth to feed, the family of the kid who found him.
Mm-hmm.
So Jerome was passed from house to house for a while until the Baptist community of Digby Neck decided that his appearance, that he must be a Catholic. And sent him to...
He must be a Catholic?
They said, well, he looks Catholic, so let's send him to the French community.
How does someone look Catholic?
I don't know. They're like, we'll claim him. So they sent him to the French community of Metagon. The government of Nova Scotia also donated some special stipends to him. Well, $2 a week to support Jerome. Not much, but this is a 1860, so I'm sure it went a little further.
It was probably, yeah.
Plus short church donations and stuff. The community continued.
I just can't that they looked at him and they're like, yep, he looks like he's a Catholic.
Look at him.
Let's go.
The community.
He's got stumps. The Lord must have taken them.
Well, he's Mediterranean, so I guess we're assuming he's Italian Catholic maybe or Spanish Catholic.
Like Roman Catholic?
Yeah, something around this. But Jerome was sent to stay with Jean Nicola, mm-hmm. Who was a speaker of several languages. So they thought maybe he can prize something out of him. But Nicola couldn't get him to talk. But Jerome stayed with Nicola for 7 more years, becoming a favorite of the ladies of the household. Apparently, Jean's...
Stumpman?
Yeah. Apparently, Jean's wife...
He pulled that sympathy card. He was pulling hoes left and right.
His Jean's wife, Juliet, and his stepdaughter, Madeline, were very fond of him. He was he was part of the family.
Mm.
So after the death of Juliet Nicola...
Good for you, Stumpman.
her husband returned to Europe, and Jerome went to stay with Dedier and Zibek Komya in Saint Alpen. I'm not good at French. He went to stay with somebody else. Okay. So he's staying with the Camus.
Okay.
The family now. The Camus used Jerome's relative fame to their advantage, charging admission and fees to see the mystery man with no legs.
Shut up. Now he's like a sideshow.
Yeah, living well on government stipend plus the sideshow.
So $2 a day or a week?
A week plus the sideshow profits. But Jerome didn't seem to mind anymore by the onlookers at this time, and he stayed there until his death on April 15th.
Because he was going to get attention from the ladies, too.
Well, he got moved to a different family. He's in a different family now.
He could still get attention from the ladies.
True.
Okay.
So his legacy and some possible explanations of Jerome. It's been suggested that Jerome...
That he was a good Christian man.
Well, we don't
know. Ladies loved him.
That much we do know.
And he was a hard worker.
That we don't know. No, he was an indoor boy.
But no, he calluses. Worked hard. He let people see his stumps.
Okay. It was assumptions made. It's been suggested that Jerome was a sailor who may have attempted a mutiny, being punished by amputation. A very skilled ship doctor would have been able to amputate his legs with the precision they're thinking, and then...
Must have been a pretty big ship.
And then they just would have cast him overboard. So he still could have concocted some sort of lie, though, just instead of not talking. So I'm still a little confused about... Something still maybe is going on with his brain here.
Yeah.
Should I also just show up into a town?
You know what they should have done? They should have had that doctor from Casper's time take a look at this man's head. Be like, you know what?
Well, that's the 1800s. His brain. We're in the 60s. We're quite different.
His brain.
That would have helped quite a bit.
Yeah, it would have given us a lot of insight.
But should I just show up into a town grunting and see if they'll take care of me? Like a...
Wouldn't it be funny if someone just like a doctor showed up, looked at this man and be like, you know what? He doesn't have legs.
I think he's missing his legs.
I think he's missing his legs.
Here's an interesting theory.
Yeah.
One suggestion is that he could have been an heir to a fortune and someone was trying to get rid of him to make way of seeking an inheritance. So like someone's trying to kill him and he's hiding, I guess.
Yeah.
But I still don't know why he would be uncommunicative and wouldn't just like one try to return to get his throne and heir. It's weird.
I mean, would you really want to go back after you had your legs severed off, though?
True, maybe, yeah.
But I would lay low for a long time.
You can still talk to these people in the town. They don't know anything about you. Just make up a story, though, you know?
Like Casper?
Yeah, you just make up a lie. So it's possible that Jerome's difficulties with producing speech could have been linked to a brain injury, most likely in the Broca's area, the part of the brain that regulates speech. Broca's? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Jerome would have been incapable of speaking, apart from some grunts and understandable, like half words, you know?
Right.
So Jerome's ability to make animalistic noises, but not replicating human language, would kind of fall into this.
Yeah.
And this is maybe where I'm leaning towards. Not sure how he got his legs amputated or why, but I don't know. Maybe a hit on the head also and just lost at sea.
I mean, possibly.
So Jerome has figured strongly in the popular imagination of Nova Scotia, and there have been several books written about the case. In 1994, director Phil Camon released a feature film about Jerome titled Jerome's Secret, La Secret de Jerome. The film starred Dennis Lapalme, a former Canadian paraplegic athlete, and it received 15 awards worldwide.
Wow.
In 2008, local historian Fraser Mooney Jr. of Yarmouth, Nova Scotia, published a book entitled Jerome, Solving the Mystery of Nova Scotia's Silent Castaway. So in this book, Moody offers a solution to the man's mysterious origins. He reports that on the other side of the bay, in Fundy Chipman in New Brunswick in 1859, so a few years before Jerome appeared in this place, a young foreigner was reported as falling through a river in ice. He developed gangrene in both legs, and due to the accident, they had to amputate him above the knee by a local doctor. Here, he became known as Gambi, probably because on awakening, he kept calling Gamba, Gamba, Italian for leg, leg. So Gambi proved to be a burden for these people of this town of Chipman.
A burden?
A burden.
He couldn't do much.
I know, but it was rumored that a passing schooner captain was paid to transport him and ditch him in a nearby town. So the captain could have possibly just sailed to the opposite bay of Nova Scotia where he got to Sandy Cove and it's like, it's your problem. They ditched him on the beach.
Wow.
So Mooney's account was controversial. Notable writers. There's just a lot of speculation. There are official governments about Gambi and it's, I think it's, some people said he was the same person. Some people said he wasn't. So it gets foggy. But what do you think? Who's Gamby?
I mean, no one really knows who Gamby is.
We're never going to know who Gamby is. No.
He couldn't.
But that's just kind of a weird one.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
It's not so much a mysterious, like, where'd he come from time? Is it a different dimension? It's just, why can't he account for it, kind of? I don't know. That was an interesting one.
Yeah.
I believe I have one more for you.
Okay.
And this is the most interesting one. This has been on the History Channel a lot.
More interesting than Gamby?
Yeah. This has popped up as different.
Does it have a happy ending like Gamby?
Doesn't have a sad ending.
Okay.
This has been on like History Channel for Ancient Aliens, for any sort of conspiracy show.
Ugh.
A lot of hidden Earth. Like, it's an interesting.
So it's up to your alley, is what you're telling me.
Yeah, I like this one.
Okay.
The Woolpit Green Children. Have you heard of this? It's an old English folklore tale.
It sounds familiar. I mean,
we'll see if it stirs anything.
Okay.
So this is possibly the most mystical story and the one that popped up the most on Crazy History Channel shows, like I was saying.
Mm-hmm.
The Legend of the Green Children of Woolpit is about two children of unusual skin color who reportedly appeared in the village of Woolpit in Suffolk, England, sometime around the 12th century.
Are we talking about feral children?
No, no.
Okay.
But possibly from a different world, from inner Earth. We don't know.
I was just mentally preparing myself for feral.
No, just maybe aliens or different dimension or inner Earth.
Okay.
The children were said to be brother and sister and were of a generally normal appearance, except their skin color was green.
Okay.
They spoke in an unknown language and would only eat raw beans. That's just the overlook. Let's get into this.
Okay.
At harvest time one day during the reign of King Stephen from 1135 to 1154...
PM?
Yes.
Okay.
No.
Oh my God.
Those are years.
Oh, I thought we were talking about time.
No, we are.
Like, but time in the sense of like a clock.
No, I think we're just talking like, you know, old and medieval.
So what year?
1135 to 1154.
Okay.
The villagers of Woolpit discovered two children, a brother and a sister, beside one of the...
I'm so dumb. I was like, time of day.
It's okay. It's okay. The villagers of Woolpit discovered two children, a brother and a sister, beside one of the wolf's pits that gave the village a name.
Mm-hmm.
Woolpit, they had wolf pits to catch wolves around. That's how they got their name.
Creative.
Yep. Their skin was green and they spoke in an unfamiliar language, and their clothing was unfamiliar as well.
Mm-hmm.
Ralph of Cogshell reports that the children were taken to the home of Richard de Caen. Richard and William agree that the pair refused all food for several days until they came across raw beans growing in a garden, which they consumed eagerly. The children gradually adapted to normal food and in that time lost their green color when they adopted our regular diet.
So they were no longer eating green beans.
No. So possibly it was just chlorophyll, their diet, who knows?
Yeah.
It was decided to baptize the children, but the boy, who appeared to be younger than the two, was sickly and died right after the baptism, probably spurring the idea for the baptism, hopefully after, if you know what I mean. Mm. So after learning to speak English...
Elaborate on your thoughts, Cameron. The world is dying. So he goes to heaven.
So the boy goes to heaven. He needs to be baptized before.
Okay.
After learning to speak English, the surviving girl explained where they came from.
Mm-hmm.
And she said it was a land where the sun never shone and the light was at permanent twilight. I would love that. No sun in the sky. It's just always glowing dusk.
I would sleep a lot.
Constantly. The girl called her home St. Martin's Land and that everything there was green. The children were unable to account for their arrival in Woolpit. They had been herding their father's cattle when they heard a loud noise that sounded like the bells of Bury's St. Edmund's Abbey, and suddenly found themselves in the wolf pit where they were found. So there were loud ringing of church bells. Mm-hmm. They started following that noise, and suddenly they were in the wolf pit.
Okay.
In another more extensive version of the story, it's said that they became lost while following the cattle into a cave.
Mm-hmm.
And after being guided by the sound of the bells through the cave, they emerged through... The cave ended up being in the other end of a wolf pit. Despite the villagers looking in there, it was just a regular pit. There were no entrances. They claimed it was the exit of an underground cave.
Okay.
Mysterious to follow sound. So the girl was employed for many years as a servant in Richard de Calne's household, where she was considered to be a very wanton and impudent woman. So she was an old-timey bitch, is what they described her as, essentially. But this is interesting because there are documents of her, and there's even a marriage here we have.
Really?
Yeah, she eventually married a man from King Lynn's, about 40 miles away from Woolpit, where she was still living shortly before the first writings about them were made. So based on the research into Richard de Calne's family history, an astronomer, writer Duncan Lennon, concluded that the girl was given the name Agnes and that she was married to a royal official named Richard Barr. So this isn't just like a folklore story. This is an actual person.
Okay.
So we might have found a paper trail for these children,
right,
or at least the girl, which is interesting.
Yeah.
And the story, like I said, has been featured on many wacky shows attributing them to aliens, Hollow Earth, time travelers, parallel universes. But we do have some other actual interpretations that are grounded in some more truth. So searching for the truth in this folklore story, there are a few different interpretations.
Okay.
There are other similar stories that were popular in medieval times depicting people traveling through tunnels or caves into different worlds. So it's possible this is just a fun pop culture story of the time that people were telling, just a different version.
Yeah.
Gerald of Wales, or Gerald probably of Wales, the medieval historian, tells a similar story of a boy from school who encountered two pygmies who led him through an underground passage into a beautiful land with fields and rivers, but not lit by the full light of the sun, a never-ending twilight again. So another one of these lands. So
okay.
Similar themes in these stories.
Yeah.
Another interpretation is that it's a garbled account of the atavistic Harvel ritual. So this is just a ritual.
What's that?
It's the reference to St. Martin.
Okay.
It's a feast. It's just an old English feast of Aboriginal tradition, essentially.
Okay.
It's a folklore associating St. Martin with the symbol of death. And it's a whole, it's your usual harvest thing, rebirth, you know, kind of stuff. So it's possible this is just some harvest story teaching us a lesson. Now, the eating of the beans has also attracted attention to folklorists because it's been noticed, too, that the habitual food of the children, the beans, is the food of the fairies in English tradition and literature. So different things, probably fairy folklore, maybe just that.
Fun.
But if it doesn't spew from just, you know, old storytelling about death or like a folklore harvest story, are there other interpretations that got lost over time?
Probably.
In 1998... Paul Harris argued for a down-to-earth explanation of the Green Children in context of a 12th century history. He identifies that they were children of Flemish immigrants who arrived in eastern England during the 12th century and were later persecuted after Henry II became king in 1154. So he proposes that the children's home of
St. Why would they get persecuted?
You'll see.
Okay.
So he proposes that the children's homeland of St. Martin's Land was the village of Fornham St. Martin's, just north of St. Edmunds, so very nearby.
Yeah.
Where their parents were likely Flemish cloth workers that settled there. In 1173, Fornham was the site and the battle of Fornham during the civil war between King Henry II and his son, young King Henry. So in this,
clever name,
rebel forces were led by Robert de Beaumont, together with a large number of Flemish mercenaries. So because of all the Flemish mercenaries that were used, it just had a anti-Flemish impact on the area for a while. So it's likely that these Flemish families were forced from the riverbanks and slaughtered and forced from their lands. So he's saying that there's likely just violence against the Flemish in the area after this because of the battle.
Okay.
So the children may have fled to Woolpit. They would have been disoriented, bewildered. They wouldn't have spoken English, and they would have dressed in unfamiliar Flemish clothing.
And they would have been green.
Well, there is something with that, though. It's believed that the children's color could be explained by hyperchromic anemia, also known as chlorosis or green sickness, the result of a dietary deficiency, which would turn you kind of green. So something that could...
Which I guess would result in her brother's death.
Yeah, and fleeing refugees, malnutrition could give you a green tinge. The issue with this, though, that people find problems with the historical interpretation because, I mean, they would have they still would have recognized them as being Flemish. It wouldn't have been an unknown land. I mean, they knew who they were because they were being persecuted.
Right.
And similar, their greenish color wouldn't have been so mysterious because lots of people in the area would have been, they would have been malnourished and suffering the same kind of thing. So that also wouldn't have been like
a shock.
Yeah. They should have been able to account for all those things. So the other thing is, though, it's proposed that this story may be about racial differences, and it would have allowed writers of the time to obliquely write kind of freely about the Welsh. So they're using creative writing to depict the political environment at the time without outright saying people are being mistreated.
Yeah, so interesting.
So it's argued that the Green Children are a memory of England's past connection to the indigenous Britons, the Anglo-Saxons, followed by the Norman invasion. Mm-hmm. So according to some, the Green Children represent a dual intrusion into William's unified version of England. On one hand, they're a reminder of the ethnic and cultural differences between the Normans and the Anglo-Saxons, mm-hmm. Given the children claim to come from St. Martin's Land, named after Martin of Tours. Some connection there, I don't know enough. But the children also embody the earlier inhabitants of the British Isles, the Welsh, the Irish and Scots, mm-hmm. who were forcibly Anglicized. So the boy in particular who dies rather than becoming assimilated represents the adjacent world that cannot be annexed. So anotherness that will be perished to endure. So essentially it's just saying this was creative writing to try to depict what was happening to the Anglo-Saxons, just people being forced out mm-hmm. and the religious reform of that time. So what do you make of this story? Do you have one of the theories that you think it could fall under?
I mean, creative writing would probably be the best way to go about it.
You're right. They were probably aliens or inner Hollow Earth.
Yeah, no. I think it's the creative writing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like it's more believable.
So these are all the big ones that you always see, especially this one. But I was sad to find that there's really no truth to this. You can kind of get to the bottom of a lot of these stories.
Yeah.
But it was still interesting.
They're fun and they're elaborate.
Yeah, and there are plenty more stories with vague origins that you can go out there, but I'm going to call it there for today.
Okay.
So thanks for listening to people who showed up from nowhere. If you have any mysterious stories or scary tales, make sure to write in an I'm Not Crazy Pod.
We would love to read it.
Yeah, if we have anything, we might be able to make a series out of it, or you can hit us up on social media at I'm Not Crazy Pod. Make sure to like and subscribe, all that good stuff. If you want more content, hit up the Majestic Jam Network, mm-hmm. Cool Classics Podcast for movies, Urban Hermit for banter. And until then, we'll check you on the next one.
Bye.
Bye.